I'll just start by saying that this is Rosemary Hall recording on behalf of the Dialect and Heritage Project. Mm-hmm. It's Wednesday the 7th of September 2022. And can I ask you please to introduce yourself?
Okay. I'm Joyce Hill, Emeritus Professor, formerly Head of the School of English at one time, Director of the Centre for Medieval Studies at one time, and Pro Vice Chancellor of the University at one time. And my specialism is as a medieval specialist, predominantly from the literature point of view, but as a medievalist, particularly in teaching, you do quite a lot of language, history of the language teaching as well, which is the way in which I worked alongside Stanley, because I didn't do directly dialect work, but we were both involved in the team of people, medievalists and historical linguists, who came together to teach students compulsorily history of the English language, which was necessary to do in the 1970s and 80s, although things have changed since then. But so it was as an immediate colleague of Stanley on particular courses, so we would, you know, compare notes and swap ideas with each other and share books occasionally. So I got to know him very well there. And for a long time, his room in the English department was next door to mine. And so habitually we had coffee together over a sandwich at lunchtime and things like that. So I got to know him a bit personally as well, and occasionally would have dinner and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I'm not a dialectologist and was never directly involved in the project, although of course it sat within the School of English, because as I'm sure you know, originally English language and English literature were two separate departments, and they came together, I think, in the late 1960s. And the medievalists, literature people, and the language people who did dialectology and also caught up with folklife studies as well, we were counted as the language end of English, because it was English language and literature, and we were all counted in there. And then the post-medieval and the people that weren't doing directly language were the lit people, which some of the medievalists thought was more than a bit awkward, because we were very much lit people, and if studying the Canterbury Tales is not lit, I don't know what is, but still, never mind. That's an old battle long since dealt with. But they were a very congenial lot to work with, the language people, particularly Stanley. He was the epitome of geniality and helpfulness.
What year did he join the school?
1971. And Stanley, it was in the days when I think there was a one-day induction for new staff across the entire university in one of the lecture theatres. And beyond that, it was kind of sink or swim. There wasn't a sort of university teaching course. There wasn't a series of inductions or anything like that. I mean, people were very helpful and very friendly. And Stanley was one of the people that sort of took me under his wing and would say things like, next week they're going to start, or the week after next, or the end of this month, or whatever it is, they're going to start asking us for draft questions for the exam paper, so you might like to start thinking about that. All of that is very useful in the first year. Very, very useful. Because your mind is so full of doing things, just keeping your head above water, because you're having to write every lecture from scratch and prepare every tutorial and every seminar. And so those kinds of forward-thinking routines are really very useful to be alerted to by a colleague who's trying to sort of think alongside you. Stanley was brilliant at that. I mean, so was Peter Meredith, but Stanley particularly was extra specially nice about that. Very practical man, and so he always thought about the practicalities of things. I mean, he didn't need to tell me the following year, because I'd kind of cottoned onto it by then, but, you know, the first year, you're not... As an incoming, because I'd just finished my PhD, so as an incoming postgraduate, and all I had done previously was an undergraduate degree and be at school, and you know that exam papers have to be set in advance, but you just don't think about how far in advance or what kind of process you go through in validating the sorts of questions and everything. So he was excellent at that. That's one of my great memories of Stanley. He was very, very... very much a departmental man, you know, very happy to make the department work and happy to do unglamorous practical things if need be. I mean, I give the example of when we moved into this suite of buildings here and the two houses across the road, we were in a horrible modern building for a long time. Well, that was I went into the horrible modern building, and we then were going to move into here. Now, moving a department the size of the School of English is quite an undertaking, and Stanley masterminded it. The head of department was sensible enough to ask him to do it, and he was good at it for two reasons. He was very practical and organised, and he got on with everybody and could get alongside people, because we all found moving difficult. You would, wouldn't you? You know. And then there's the fight over who's going to have which room when they're non-standard rooms and all that kind of thing. And Stanley managed it in a way that I honestly think nobody else would have done, but he put in hours and hours and hours and hours of working it all out. It's the kind of man he was.
And you ended up next door to each other after that move?
Not then. We were next door to each other in the horrible modern building. So we could hear each other through the wall because it was a single breeze block with the heating ducts running the full length of the building. So sound went through. And I mean, if we were teaching the same on quite a tight programme of seminars for the history of the language, and there was a particular topic for a particular week, I could see whether he was 5 minutes ahead of me and covering the ground or 5 minutes behind me. I mean, it was just... And if one of us made the students laugh or something, you know, we'd be saying over lunchtime, well, you got them laughing this morning. How did you manage to make the great vowel shift funny? You know, so he was a great colleague. He was really fantastic. And I think that's the real reason why he was successful with the dialect survey. Because he could get on with anybody. I mean, I'm sure he thought certain people were awkward and other people were not awkward, but he could and did get on with everybody. He was immensely approachable, very congenial, had no kind of pomposity about him whatsoever, and never hid the fact that he was a Yorkshireman through and through, and in a sense became slightly more so when he was dealing with farmers out in the Dales. You know, his Yorkshire accent, which he never lost, would be a little bit stronger. Not that he was playing games or performing or anything like that. It was just that he was naturally drawn into his warmth of empathy made him modify his way of talking as a way of reaching out to them in the same kind of way that you're nodding and smiling now. He would nod and smile and also adjust his speech so that he was on the same level as them, same kind of thing as you might bend down to talk to a small child. You know, I mean, it's that kind of thing, and he was very good at that.
Did you ever hear any of the recordings?
Occasionally, I'd hear bits and pieces, and sometimes through the wall, I would hear other kinds of work that Stanley did for the police. He did quite a bit of analytical work for the police. He was very, very skilled in analysing dialect, not just regionally, but on a kind of city basis, and even, you know, North Birmingham as opposed to South. You know, I mean, he was really, really very good. And so he would spend hours and hours playing tapes, the same piece of tape over and over again, analysing the vowels and so forth. And then would sometimes disappear and would be giving expert witness statements for the police. And he got involved in the Yorkshire Ripper, of course, particularly with the hoax tapes. But I mean, he didn't know they were hoax tapes, but he analysed them correctly, and that put the police on what turned out to be the wrong direction. But that wasn't Stanley's fault, that was the hoaxer's fault. So he was very, very gifted, I think is true to say. And I'm sure Harold Orton, whom I knew a bit, was dramatically important in driving the dialect survey, but in terms of the feet on the ground and actually making it work, it was Stanley.
Can you tell me a bit more about your interactions with Orton?
Yes, well, I knew him in that he, when we were in, when I first came in 71, for a few years, he was producing, I'm not sure whether it was a summary booklet of maps or something. Clive Orton will tell you about that, I think. It wasn't the basic volumes. I think the basic volumes had already been done. And he had got, he was working in a room at the end of the corridor with Sue Powell and Clive Upton. And both Sue and Clive did some first year tutoring in Old English, History of the Language, that kind of thing. And so since I was in charge of one of the streams of what they were doing, I would be going in there sometimes to talk to them about what they would be doing next or what we would be doing next year or whether we'd modify things and that sort of stuff. So I'd be popping in and out to see Clive and Sue more often than not, but would pass the time of day with Harold while you were in there, because I mean you wouldn't go in and suddenly pretend he wasn't there, you know, so we would chat a bit. But I didn't get to know him terribly well, really only in that kind of way through the through going in to deal with Clive, and then we'd occasionally see him wandering along the corridor and pass the time of day, but that was sort of it really, because he didn't have I mean, he had a position in the department in that he was overseeing that project, but in terms of the department functioning as a university department vis-a-vis students, he didn't actually have a role, and that was my, you know, obviously that was this, my kind of area of activity. You'll have heard from other people that he lost an arm in the First World War, and I think he had to learn to write with his other hand. I think he was like Nelson, who similarly had to do likewise. But he never made any reference to it or fuss and bother about it at all. I mean, he just... well, I suppose the First World War was quite a long time ago by the time you get to 1971, and so, you know, it was no longer news as far as he was concerned. But he never made any fuss or bother about it. And I think almost in a way, you'd spend a few hours with him before you'd even noticed, and then you would realise because of something that was done. So that was really all I knew about him. I do remember one time, this is a bit of an anecdote really, but we were doing, there's a story in Bede's Ecclesiastical History, which translated from Latin into Old English in the reign of King Alfred. And it's the foundation myth story of how Christian poetry gets to be written using the old Germanic style. It's the story of Cædmon and being inspired by God to sing the song of creation and everything. And we would do a snippet of it because it was in the reader that the students had to work with in the first year. And I had just done a group with a group of students, and they'd struggled to translate. Well, they were struggling to translate anyway because they were fairly near the beginning of their period of learning Old English. But there was I was trying constantly to say, this is actually the same word that we still got in English, wherever you possibly could do that. And I would sometimes say it aloud, because the spelling might have changed, but if you say it aloud, you'll perhaps hear that it's the word that we've got. And it was telling us the story of how Cædmon had withdrawn, when there was a jubeur shipper, which was, you know, a beer drinking session of the estate workers. He didn't like to join in the singing, and so he'd withdrawn to the cowshed, and where he was to sleep with the animals. And it said that he was in them shippener. Now, being a Devonian myself, shippen is what you call it now to this very day. I mean, it is a shippen, and that's what it is, and why should anybody call it anything else, was what I thought when I was a child. Never occurred to me that any other term was used anywhere else in the country. And that if anybody called it cowshed, well, that was because they didn't want know what the proper name was. You know, that was a descriptive term as far as I was concerned, and that was, you know... So, of course, when the students couldn't do it, I said, well, say it. You'll hear the word. It looks a bit strange because it starts off S-C-I-P-E-N. But if you actually say it, you'll hear what it is. Well, of course, they were all completely stuck. They hadn't got a clue what I was on about. So I said, well, in them shipping is what's still called today. Da-da. Thinking that, you know, why didn't they wake up and realise And immediately after that, I went into the dialect room at the end, and they were doing the maps for the terms for cowshed and byre and all the rest of it. And shippen, they'd drawn the lines to show where the divisions were, and it was in front of Harold, he was just checking. And it had got a line more or less on the Devon-Cornwall border and the Devon-Somerset border. And there was Devon in the middle with Shippen. And so I did a, goodness gracious me, I said, looking at it, that explains this morning. So of course then Harold wanted to know what I was exclaiming about. So I then did have this... Oh, and he was delighted to know that as a good Devonian, I still knew that it was Shippen and that you wouldn't call it anything else, would you? You know? And I wasn't a farm girl. I mean, I was a townie, but you just knew that that's what it was. And he was quite twinkly-eyed about that and thought that it was great fun. And I think it made his morning.
Do you remember any of the other editorial staff, so research assistants or sub-editors?
Don't think so. No, I knew Sue and Clive because, of course, I had a lot to do with them because they were on my teaching team in my early years. And then, of course, Clive came back into the department before I left, so I knew him. And Sue Powell went off to other universities, and so I would meet her at conferences and things sometimes. And now, she's actually very friendly with a particularly close friend of mine who lives down in Tewkesbury. So that was why I was able to get her email address from Graham down in Tewkesbury. And so we've seen each other in a sense with a few circumstances like that. And so I've kept in touch with them, and that means that I've got continuing knowledge of who they are. But I don't think I remember anybody else. I mean, I might, if you rattled off a list of names, I might nod and smile and say, oh, yes, that's a name I remember. But I don't remember the people independently, really.
Could you tell me a bit more about what Stanley was like as a person and the time you spent together socially?
Yes, he was very relaxed, very approachable, very friendly, in the kind of way that I was talking about how he could be with... mixing with all sorts of people, as also within the department when he was organising moving the department from one bit of the university to another. Very, very easy to get on with. He was devastated when his first marriage broke up, but he did find happiness subsequently, and I carried on, you know, meeting with them socially then. And it was always good to, if you were having a crowd of people, it was always good to invite Stanley along because he would help oil the wheels, you know, if people got a bit stuck or didn't really know each other very well, and he would help get them to know each other.
Would he talk about dialect?
Yes, he would. And he was full of, you know, he could do, I can't remember of any of his anecdotes, but I mean, he was good at anecdotes because he'd got plenty in a sense because of the work that he'd been doing. I mean, he used to travel around, I believe, when he was doing it in a caravan. And so would be really kind of going out there in through the sticks and all around the place. But he was a very skilled phonetician and was able to both, well, there's the two dimensions of being a good phonetician, isn't there? The mastery of the more detailed notation, which, I mean, I learned some very basic phonetics, but it was at a very high level. It wouldn't have got you very far in a way. Useful to know it, but wouldn't have been any good for the dialect survey because it wasn't detailed enough. And he'd got a very sharp ear. And in truth, prided himself on it, I think. I think he liked to know that he'd got those skills, but indeed he did have them, so he was right to be proud of them because they're not skills that everybody's got, and he had nurtured them in order to do the job properly. And although he was confident in his skills, which was why he was willing to do the sometimes quite difficult and taxing police work and then stand up in court and deliver, as it were, he he never paraded it. It was something that he was just confident of inside himself, which continued to make him approachable, you know, because he didn't wear his knowledge on his sleeve.
And do you remember when you first moved to the school, when you first joined the school, when you first became aware of the Survey of English Dialects?
Oh, pretty well right away, because Leeds was already, I mean, even as an undergraduate, I knew that it published Leeds Studies in English, for example. There weren't quite as many journals in publication then in the 1960s when I was an undergraduate from 65 to 68 and then as a postgraduate from 68. I didn't do a master's degree, I went straight on to do a PhD from 68 to 71. And I already knew that Leeds was a good place, particularly for language work and historical study. And I also knew Arthur Cawley, for example, who was the professor of medieval literature, but I mean, he was head of the subsection which included Stanley. And I knew him because he had edited, for instance, came across his name. It was an undergraduate because we used the Everyman edition of the mystery plays and he had edited that. So I knew of his name and I knew that they had done some dialect, but I didn't know anything more about it than that. Well, I think that's a fair amount to know when you're an undergraduate. But yes, it was. I think I got told those sorts of things when it was clear as an undergraduate that I was kind of moving in that direction, not in the direction of dialects, but I mean in historical linguistics and literature work.
When did you become head of school?
In 1998.
So it would have been before your time that the
I think
Institute
was it 80, no perhaps it might have been 1999. Yeah, it was 1999, I think. Sorry, I could have looked up my CV this morning if I'd thought about it, but I think it was 1995, 1998, 1999. Yeah, it would have been 1999. Yeah.
So it would have been before your time as head of school that the Dialect and Folklife Institute closed down.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember that time?
Not particularly, no. It was Stuart Sanderson who was the head of it, I think at the point of its demise, and he had been head of the school as a whole for a short while. But I think the dialect survey, there was no more funding for it, and then there's the question of staffing it if you haven't got the funding for it, and there was a general sense that the volumes had been done, and that was it. And in a kind of a way, at that moment, there was increasingly a move away from the difficult side of linguistic study and historical literature. Generally, across the country, I don't just mean in Leeds. So, and there was a breaking down of the sense that departments ought to do everything. And I think, I'm not saying that that bore particularly strongly on Leeds, but it was part of the mood of the English departments generally. I think that in a way didn't help Leeds hang on to that particular area of strength. And in a way, there wasn't somebody here to say, actually, there's more work to be done, and these are the ways that you could do it, and this is the way you could get money for it. And I'm not sure that that would necessarily have worked in the mood of the time.
So you didn't have too much to do with Stuart Sanderson?
Well, only insofar as he was head of department. I mean, obviously, you have to do with the head of department a bit, but I didn't. I don't think I caused any trouble. I just got on with what I was doing and got good module reports from students, and so he didn't want me in there to discuss why I wasn't being a satisfactory lecturer or something like that. So I mean, it just didn't, we just sort of dealt with each other in examiners meetings and board of studies meetings, and I would go and see him about a particular issue sometimes, but we just got on with our work on parallel lines, liaised when we needed to, you know.
And do you remember when Orton retired?
No, I mean, I can't remember anything specific about it. We got to a point where there was no longer that room at the end of the corridor, and Harold wasn't there anymore, and neither were the likes of Sue or Clive, and so it just sort of ended. I can't remember any particular...
And Stanley?
Well, I can remember, I mean, in a way, I can remember Stanley retiring. We had a big dinner for him at Peter Meredith's house, which we did for each of our colleagues as they gradually retired, Charles Barber and people like that. Peter is very hospitable and has a gigantic house. And so we had a delightful dinner and, you know, there were speeches. I don't mean formal speeches, but there were speeches made about Stanley and things were done and photographs were put out and all that kind of thing. But that's just a mark of how much people enjoyed Stanley's company. So I remember that. And I remember feeling, gosh, that's going to be a loss to the department, because he was just such a rock for the department and just such a sort of busy worker for the department. That sounds a funny thing to say, but departments benefit if there's a few of those people about. And I thought, you know, I really will miss him on a day-to-day basis. I mean, I didn't need him as a prop anymore like I did in the first year or two, but it's just comfortable to have a few colleagues around that you're just so relaxed with that if something's made you go completely up the wall, you can go and let off steam about it and be thoroughly indiscreet and you feel all the better for it at the end, you know. So he was one of those sorts of people that you could do that with. Didn't keep in touch with him all that much after, but that's a bit of... I mean, he didn't live in Leeds anyway. So we did see him occasionally on social occasions, but not in the in a particularly active way.
Moving on to sort of the next phase of dialect study at Leeds, were you head of school when the LAVC was put together by Clive and his colleagues?
I don't think so. I was only head of school for 2 years because then I got poached by and the Universities UK to be head of a policy unit for the whole of higher education in the UK, in England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And so I then ended up working in London for 5 years, 4 years, 5 years, 4 years. And so I commuted to London then. And David Lindley, who'd been head of department immediately before me, took over, I think, for the 1 year that I was due to, because it was 3-year rotations for head of department at that stage. And I think, and David, who passed away last year, took over from me, volunteered to take over, bless him, so that I didn't feel too guilty about whizzing off to London, which was a nice and interesting thing to do and helped my pension no end.
Just try not to touch the wire.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
It's fascinating stuff, Joyce. What does dialect mean to you now?
I think what they did when they did it was very, very important, because I think the huge degree of movement that there's been socially and geographically means that there has been a degree of, I mean, I don't mean that we've lost dialects, we haven't, but there's been a degree of homogenisation, if that's such a word, which I think, jumping in reasonably quickly after the Second World War, captured particularly the older generation, the pre-war, you know, maybe born in the late 19th century even, and who hadn't moved about much. I mean, I had grandparents who, my grandfather had never been outside Devon, I don't think, ever, except when he was in South Wales during the Second World War, during the First World War, because he was a master mason, and he was drafted. He had the option of going into the army. Well, he had the moral obligation. There wasn't conscription at the beginning of the First World War, but he had the moral obligation of going into the army as a fit young man or going to South Wales to help build the pit shafts and the buildings above ground. They needed master masons in order to oversee that because they were opening up a lot of mines in order to produce the coal for the Navy ships. And he went over to South Wales. That is the farthest he ever went. And he died in his late 70s, never even having been to London. And he thought that was perfectly normal and that it was quite exceptional to have gone to South Wales. I mean, that's the kind of world it was. And he lived in a town. It wasn't as if he was in some kind of remote bit of the Dartmoor or something, you know.
What was his language like? Do you remember any words?
That was quite strongly Devonian. And he called young girls maid and maiden, for example. And he called me little maid because he called my mother maid rather than by her actual name. And so when I came along, he always called me little maid, almost as if it was my name. I can scarcely remember him calling me by my name. I mean, he was very fond of me, don't get me wrong. It was a term of affection. But, you know, it's a whole other kind of world, really. They captured that. And I think that's something that you would capture something quite different now, I think. Quite different. I mean, I'm not saying that what you would capture now wouldn't be equally valuable in its own terms. And there would be the extra dimension of immigration and then the naturalisation of the second and third generation as well of immigrants. And that would be fascinating to study. And that's just equally valid as an exercise in dialectology. But I think it was very, very valuable to capture that kind of survival. And of course, it's not a static survival because dialect and language is always changing. So it was, even that was just a snapshot, but it was a snapshot of a layering that you couldn't capture now in the same way, I think. Mm-hmm. And so I think it, to be honest, the nation can youthfully embark upon more projects of that kind now to see where we are.
Couldn't agree more.
Quite.
We've been asking everybody towards the end of their interviews about their own dialect story. So you told me a bit about your grandfather.
Yes. Well, I'm a Devonian, and I mean, you can hear it in my speech, because I don't think, I mean, apart from things like shippen, I don't think I use dialect words. But you see, I don't think anybody in Devon would say that shippen was a dialect word, which of course it is. Once you get outside and look back in, you see that it is. But I mean, the kind of language in lexical terms that my grandfather would use, I was never brought up to use. And I left home at 18. As an undergraduate, I went to London and then I came to York and then I came to Leeds. And I've lived in America for a couple of years and things like that. And apparently when I came back from America, everybody told me I sounded mid-Atlantic. So I'd obviously picked up, I mean, I know I picked up some bits of vocabulary because it's awkward if you don't really. You have to use the local terms if you want to communicate. And I was living in Tennessee into the bargain. So I really had to go an extra mile to communicate in some contexts there. But I think I'd lost the mid-Atlantic fairly soon after I got back. So I'm clearly a Devonian. I mean, at least I'm sure Stanley would pick up that it was Devon, but everybody picks up that it's the Southwest. It would be, it's the A and the R and that kind of thing.
Any words from Leeds that you've picked up?
Oh, goodness. I don't use love when I'm talking to people. That's one thing I don't do. That's very difficult to say because I've been living here since 1971. And so it's quite tricky to get outside yourself and look inwards. I do sometimes refer to the stream at Addle as the Beck, but then it is called Addle Beck, so in a kind of a way that draws you into doing that. And I talk about being up in the Dales, but then it is the Yorkshire Dales, and I wouldn't use Dale down in the southwest because there's nowhere called the Dales because it's one of the Viking names. So, but that's not what you're meaning, really, I don't think, because those are topographical things. I can't, out of the top of my head, think of things. Somebody else could probably tell me half a dozen words, because it would be pretty inconceivable living here most of my life and not picking up at least a handful.
Do you ever have people locally here commenting on your Southwest words or accent?
Not really, because people in Leeds associate me with the university, and so they assume that I'm not particularly likely to be local anyway, so they don't imagine that I'm going to sound Yorkshire, and indeed I know I don't, but, you know, so it wouldn't give anybody pause for thought, I think, really.
Mm. Did you ever go back down to Devon?
I've got a cousin who lives in Torquay, so I haven't just lately because of COVID and things. But I do go down there at least once. Normally, I go down there at least once a year, and I do a tour. I've got a very dear friend who lives in Linton, in North Devon, and I've got my cousin down in Torquay, and I've got another friend who, our mothers were pregnant at the same time, and she was born. She's 6 months older than me, but we've known each other since we were babies. And so I nearly always go down to Barbara, stay in Linton for a bit, then drive from Linton to Torquay, visit Alan and his wife, and then come up to Exeter and at least have lunch with Angela and her husband, and then drive home. And I have a very close friend who lives in Tewkesbury. That's the one who knows Sue Powell. And I go down there often twice in a year now. But then Tewkesbury's that much nearer than North Devon. I mean, it's only 165 miles, whereas Linton is 325. And that does make a difference.
How do you feel when you hear a Devon voice?
Oh, well, I mean, if you hear it on the radio or the television, I always pick it up. And if they're trying to imitate it on the television, I'm sitting there thinking, well, they're clearly not Devonian. They've only just learned how to do that. You know, it's ingrained. In terms of recognition, it's absolutely ingrained, I think. And so when I hear people speaking, I know that I had a friend from Essex. Well, she's actually Yorkshire born and bred, but spent her middle years at high school and so on over in Manchester. She's a medic and she's retired down in Essex. And she was up this last week staying for a few days. And we went out for tea and we were mooching around a sort of posh food shop. We'd gone somewhere nice for coffee and they do delicatessen stuff. And we were mooching around there. And somebody in the next bit of aisles, she said something like, Mary said to me, oh, there's somebody from your neck of the woods. And I immediately said very sharply, they're not Devonian, though. And she said, aren't they? And I said, no, that's Somerset. And fairly near Bristol, into the bargain, I said, it's a big difference, you know. And so there's a, you know, but she could hear the southern, southwest softness, as people often say. But I'd noticed that it was a fairly sharp Somerset accent, but I'd thought nothing of it. I just categorised it as that, you know.
Yeah. Oh, you've been so generous with your time. It's been a real privilege to speak to you today.
Well, it's very kind of you. You've been nodding and smiling very encouragingly. I hope I've been able to, you know, contribute something.
Absolutely. Is there anything else you'd like to tell me about or any memories?
No, I can't think that there is. These are nice pictures. Can I just have a little look?
Of course, of course.
For a minute or two.
So we think those were taken for publicity purposes, the ones of the editorial staff.
Right.
Around the late 60s, early 70s. And then this is a press conference at the Waldorf Hotel in 1962.
Oh, goodness me.
So that's Stanley.
Yes, indeed.
And there's Harold there and the publisher, Martin Arnold.
Mm-hmm. Gosh. Stanley always looked younger than his years.
He looks very young in those pictures,
yeah,
doesn't he?
But he always looked younger than his years. That was he never aged, in a way, if you know what I mean. Some people don't, do they? He was always quite sort of smooth-featured and you know, didn't go... But the point when he retired, he'd still got a fairly decent head of hair and things, which is always makes men look quite a lot younger, doesn't it? Mm. Oh, there he is again, too. Yeah, it's nice to see the pictures of him.
I've been trying to figure out what building that is. In the archive, it's... Sorry, this one.
Oh, this one.
In the archive, it says they're standing outside the Institute of Dialect and Folklife Studies, now the School of English.
Well, it says University of Leeds, doesn't it?
Mm.
Yes, and it says Institute of Dialect and Folklife Studies. Now, that, I think... it's not this set of buildings. It's up nearer the Students' Union, I think, was where they were. But I don't exactly know where, but there's some old buildings up there. And whether it's still there, I don't know. I think it might be. But that was when it was separate English language, you know, that language end of things was up there. And I'm pretty sure that would be likely before it was fully amalgamated then, maybe, I don't know. But they were up towards somewhere in the region of Beech Grove House, I think. I don't think that is Beech Grove House, it's the wrong colour brick. But it was sort of in the general direction of those old buildings up near the Students' Union, I think that was where they were. So that's probably it.
Excellent.
But of course, the university, it was in the 1960s that the university bought up the ground that goes down towards town from sort of here downwards, where there's all those nasty concrete buildings. The university bought it all up as slums and did slum clearance. And then the university began to expand in the wake of the Robbins Report, of course, in the late 1960s. When the intake for universities went up from 2% of the age cohort to 5% of the age cohort, rather astonishing. And as it expanded down the hill, it was the university, the city fathers were building the inner ring road, and the university put extra money in for it to be sunk. And that's why, where it passes beyond the... on the campus, between us and the hospital, in fact, between us and the LGI, which in a sense is part of the university because of the medical school and all the rest, then the fact that it's sunk there is... I mean, the road was going to be built anyway. The university didn't pay for the road to be built. The road was going to be built. But the university, I always understood, put in extra money to have it sunk so that it wasn't actually cutting... in a way, wasn't cutting the university in half, because the university foresaw that it would actually go right the way down to the LGI, which it does.
Yeah. Wow. Really interesting. I'm just learning more and more about Leeds, but the buildings around the area where I'm staying, which is only just sort of Clarendon Road.
Yes.
That kind of area. Is a lot of that owned by the university?
Oh, yes, the university owns swathes of that right out to Clarendon Road. I think one thing that you really have to take your hat off to the university fathers, as it were, in the 1960s, they saw the opportunity to buy up relatively cheap housing. Some of this was nasty terraces going down into the centre of town, so that was slum clearance stuff. Some of these over towards Clarendon Road were slightly more gracious streets. But they built up, bought up a lot of that, converted some of the terraces pro tem into teaching rooms and so forth. So they were in a very good position to be able to expand into what then became one of the larger universities in the country, and yet have a campus, because it is very much a campus university still, not as kind of green and leafy as York with its lake and everything else, but nevertheless, very much a campus university and right on the city centre doorstep. Much more so even than Manchester, for example. So, you know, really have to take your hat off to the university for that, I think.
I had an email from someone who was a research assistant in, I think, the 70s. She's called Fran Gillespie now, but she was called Claire Gilbert at the time.
Vaguely remember the name, but that's, I don't remember the person. Yeah.
She said that in at the back of one of the terraced brick houses that they worked in, when it was excavated, they found infant bones and things, and there had been a...
I don't know about that.
No.
No.
What was the term she used? A baby cellar or a baby... I can't remember.
Don't know. But I'm sure there were all kinds of weird things that went on in some of these rather less salubrious bits of the university.
It's interesting trying to figure out which buildings were which and all that stuff.
I mean, over towards Clarendon Road, there were some quite gracious buildings. And indeed, when the when Queen Victoria and Albert came to open the Leeds City Hall, Leeds Town Hall, with the one with the dome and the clock, the person that hosted them, who was Lord Mayor at the time, and she knighted him that day, he had a house on Clarendon Road, and that's where they stayed. So that was a posh bit there. The important thing was that it was on rising ground, so it was above the smoke. Because in the 1700s, the merchants in Leeds were still living down by the river and the canal. And then in the 1800s, they started moving up the hill to get away from the smoke. As the Industrial Revolution kind of caught hold and the river became increasingly polluted. Well, it's not polluted now, but I mean, you know.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, it's all fascinating. Mm. Thank you so much.
Well, I do talks for Leeds Civic Trust, you see.
Oh, do you?
Historic talks is one of the things that I do as a sideline just to keep myself amused. And that's how I've got some of the sort of history of the city
Wonderful.
At my fingertips.
Oh, great. Yeah. I should sign up for a talk.
Supper walks.